welcome to the 80th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 101 years to the day that Jack Hobbs made his first class debut. A famous fast bowler once said of him, "It were hard work bowling at him, but it were something you wouldn't have missed for nothing." We're still waiting for someone to say the same about Reverse Rep Radio.
But on this episode, we've got all kinds of unmissable gems, I think is the only way to look at it. We're going to be talking about the start of the county season in England, the good and the bad sides of that. We've got a little bit on international cricket. But as ever, what we're really going to be doing is delving into the weird and wonderful back alleys of cricket. We're going to be reviewing the crazy history of cricket games that don't happen on a grass pitch. We're also going to be reviewing the wonderfully named Fatty Batter by Michael Simpkins. Now, you started off by talking about Jack Hobbs. Of course, Jack Hobbs hailed from Cambridge, which is in fact the same town that this podcast, in a way, hailed from.
So we share something with him, and probably
I like to think we have a lot of affinity with the possibly question mark the greatest batsman that England ever produced. So, but anyway, moving rapidly on into the 21st century, in terms of England producing great batsmen. Now, Ben Duckett, he's someone whose name has kind of come across my radar, mostly because I've always been slightly afraid of pronouncing his name and saying something unspeakable on the podcast. But he's caught your eye over the last couple of weeks, hasn't he?
It's a good name, actually, isn't it? It's a sort of cricket comic book hero sort of name.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, he's been one of the few shining lights out of what has been a kind of inevitably muted start to the county season. This is what happens when you start your opening games in the second week of April. There have been plenty of rain-affected draws. But in one of those draws, the 21-year-old Mr. Duckett made a 282 unbeaten 282 for Northants against Sussex in an innings where the next highest score was just 51. Now, Duckett has previously been seen as a hot prospect, but a hot prospect with some issues. As in the Under-19 World Cup, he did incredibly well for England. In fact, the only player previously who's done as well as him in such a competition was a certain Alistair Cook. But he's then since run into considerable problems. He's been dropped previously from the Northants squad on several occasions for generally just showing a sort of Samit Patel-esque lack of commitment towards his fitness, and also a drink driving ban. However, they've moved him up from... He was sort of a dashing middle-order player, and they've now moved him up to opener, and it seems to have paid instant dividends.
So how would you characterise his batting?
I've seen nothing of it other than a very, very short YouTube clip that was based on this. And I think what seemed to be, certainly from the match reports of this, was that this was a typical sort of early season struggle for most batsmen, and yet Duckett kind of made it look easy. And I think it's one of the joys of following county cricket. You're always kind of on the lookout. You're sort of always on the lookout for the next great talent, the next exciting thing. So he certainly has captured the early plaudits. Now, you've been more focused on, well, someone who was certainly seen as one of England's great talents.
Yeah, I was just really, really struck by the sadness of James Taylor's retirement. I mean, retirement just seems like completely the wrong word for a 26-year-old. Essentially, I'm sure we're all familiar with the story. It was discovered that after a sort of a period of ill health, it was discovered that he had a degenerative heart disease, which is also shared by a famous footballer whose name I've already forgotten. I pay so little attention to football, but you might know Andy.
Fabrice Muamba, apparently. Yeah.
There we go.
Who actually had to be saved by defibrillation equipment on the pitch, which is, you know, gives you an example of how undiscovered and untreated, this is a. I mean, it's a killer condition.
It is a killer condition, a very serious condition, and it's kind of lucky that it's been spotted in James Taylor. It's a condition that needs careful monitoring, and therefore, I mean, much of the trickiness around his retirement is that actually, you know, he's 26 years old, and it's a preventative retirement. Mm-hmm. There's no reason that he couldn't go out. I was looking at some report recently that was talking about the fact that when Northants had their kind of fitness, drills and stuff, he was always the person who was most fit. He clearly, you know, he can go out and play cricket.
Yeah.
It's just a preventative thing, and that, you know, at some point he might just drop dead on the cricket pitch. Mm-hmm. And so this is why he's been forced into retirement. And that, for me, is so much a part of the tragedy of the whole thing. It's not as if he's actually got an injury that means he can't play cricket. He can. Mm-hmm. It's just preventative. But the thing that I've been really struck by, actually, is, you know, inevitably in this day and age, with a guy who's 26 in, you know, 2016, this has been sort of played out all over social media, and actually, James Taylor is quite active on social media, on Twitter and Instagram and all of those kinds of things. And what I've been really struck by is the really kind of sanguine attitude that he's taken towards the whole thing. In a world where kind of hysteria reigns, he's shown a really mature attitude to the sort of there's more to life than cricket, kind of balance to the perspective that he's brought to things. We talk a lot on this podcast about the difficulties of sort of retiring gracefully and retiring at the right time. And I think it's a really special thing to see that someone who has been forced to retire, it's not his choice at all, obviously, but forced to retire under these kind of pretty awful circumstances, has done it with, a considerable amount of dignity and a considerable amount of humour as well.
So one constant throughout all the coverage of this has been the refrain that he showed extraordinary tenacity just getting to where he did. I mean, he was constantly written off as being too small to really make it as a top-level batsman, and he sort of completely disproved that, basically, I understand, through working harder than anyone. And I think the constant refrain has basically been that tenacity, that willingness to work, will see him in good stead now. And you do get the impression that, I mean, I think there are some sportsmen that they lose the game they love and they've got nothing. The way he's responded, I agree with you, does seem to suggest an impressive amount of perspective on his part.
So we wish James Taylor all the best for whatever the future holds. In other parts of the cricketing world, the Pakistanis are back on your radar.
Yeah, this really struck me. An interview that Grant Taylor, the Zimbabwean, who's now Pakistan's batting coach, gave to Crick Info.
Grant Flower probably rather than Grant Taylor, but that's okay.
What did I say?
You said Grant Taylor, but that,
Okay, apologies,
small difference.
Grant Flower. It was really striking just because you get so few good interviews now. I mean, they're anodyne, they're very media trained, and you generally learn nothing. And this was such an openly critical interview, culminating in Flower's suggestion that sometimes I wonder if the guys are being professional enough. I'm not sure if they train as hard as the other best players in the world. Clearly, there's some strategy behind what Flower's doing. This is intended as a kick up the backside for this Pakistan team. But there was also something really depressing about this. I've always enjoyed watching Pakistan play. I know it's a bit of a stereotype, but they do have these wonderful mercurial mavericks who can just make stuff happen. But I thought, given the fanaticism this Pakistan team attracts, given what they mean to a country that has got so many problems, so much struggle, it's just so sad to hear about this lack of commitment. You think there must be the number of people who would kill to play for this Pakistan side. And I think what was really unfortunate about it is it totally tallied with my experience of watching a bit of Pakistan during the World 2020, where the fielding was abysmal for an international side, and the running between the wickets was sort of comical. You saw Australia hunting, and England, for example, hunting down every single, every second that was out there. But no, it was a
And
really interesting bit of insight.
you do wonder as well how far it is the kind of growing pains that a team has to go to through to go from essentially being an amateur setup to being a sort of fully professional setup. And I realize that kind of I'm in danger of sounding kind of incredibly patronizing towards the Pakistani team, but exactly for that reason that they have had people, and it's a problem that the West Indies have as well, because they have had people, the people who can just stroll onto the pitch and score 110 balls and then stroll off again, that actually there has, there's not this sense of kind of rigor and discipline that perhaps you'd have in countries where realistically you probably have actually less gifted cricketers who depend on those kinds of things. So I wonder whether as well there's a little bit of a kind of culture clash between a Grant Flower and a Pakistan, and just in terms of there being two very different cultures here talking about how to make cricket teams work.
Now, you've been focusing on a different sort of lack of professionalism.
Yes, indeed, very true. Nice little segue there. So yeah, no, I was just amused by something I saw that was reporting on the fact that an Australian company based off in Byron Bay, which is, if anyone who knows Australia will know that Byron Bay is a place that you go away to go away to be a bit sort of artistic and to maybe indulge in some substances that might heighten your appreciation of life. And the company based in the aforementioned Byron Bay has developed the Shane Warne Bong. Now, I think we will probably lose our family-friendly rating if we spell out for anyone who doesn't know what a bong is, but I'm sure we all do know what a bong is. And what's most interesting about this is that so it's a bong in the shape of Shane Warne's head, but it's also Shane Warne dressed as a speed dealer, so a dealer of the drug speed rather than anything else. I'm not quite sure personally what a speed dealer looks like, but apparently these people know. But also with 20-carat gold earrings in each of his ears, which apparently, presumably makes it quite an expensive and kind of collectible item, one way or other. I'm not sure whether there's some kind of subliminal, satirical, subtle message here that I'm not kind of sharp enough to get, or if it's just a reflection on the fact that Warren has a certain
You
liking
see, I would have
for the high
thought,
life.
given that Warne during his career, and I think, and very much still now, particularly on the poker side of things, shows a constant willingness to be on adverts and PR. Really, what this company need to do is to get Warne advertise. To get Warne holding the bong of his head. I mean, that surely has to be the next step here. He
Absolutely.
does have a
Are
track
you
record.
finding this third day washed out test match a bit dull? Well, I've got just the thing for you.
Well, he actually wouldn't be a bad advert for it because he was always quite famous for the sort of cheeky cigarette, wasn't he? The idea that
The
if you go
cigarette on the
around the back of
balcony,
the.
yeah, that was always the one. I mean, there was that time that he was seen openly smoking at Lord's or wherever. But what's also curious is the fact that this company has chosen the cast of characters that they've chosen around which to sculpt this apparatus consists also of Donald Trump, Britney Spears, and the Australian singer Shannon Null, who, if you're not Australian, you almost certainly wouldn't know about. And it seems like, yeah, if you don't like Warren, then this company's definitely got something for you.
From the archives. Now, picture the scene. It is a cold, wet November afternoon, but all you want in your life is a little bit of the joy of cricket. Toby is going to give us an introduction to the world of cricket board games.
So the idea for this feature sprung up from the book that we're going to review in a moment, Fatty Batter, as it's wonderfully called. And in that game, the author plays a game called How's That, or Ow's That, as it's spelt. And that sort of set me off thinking and reminding me of when I was at school and when we had wet games, as they were called, which were not games that were played in the wet, were quite the opposite. It was when it was raining and we had to stay indoors. And we often had to play cricket board games. And so I set off on a little hunt around the merry world of cricket board games. And I suddenly realised that if I was actually going to do this justice, I would be here for about 3 days talking about them because are so many that have been inspired
And that's
by the
actually going to
game
be a
of cricket.
follow-up episode, isn't it, where you just talk
And that
for
is
3 days on cricket board
absolutely.
games.
So actually, every feature for the next 74 episodes are going to be
A
on a
different
different
cricket board
cricket
game.
board game. One of the earliest, so what I've done is just taken a sort of a small selection of the breadth of them, and what I deliberately wanted to do here was avoid the computer game version of cricket games as much as anything because I never played them when I was a child, but also because there is something delightfully simple about many of these games. And one of the earliest is actually one of the simplest, and that's a game called Pencil Cricket. And Pencil Cricket involves all you need is two pencils, those pencils that are hexagonal. Actually, I don't know what the name for something with six sides is. Is that
I
hexagonal?
think
I
that'll
can't
do,
remember.
yeah.
It'll do. And what you do is you shave off each side of the pencil so that you can write on them. And on one pencil, you write the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6. And instead of number 5, you write, "How's that?" And you roll that first pencil. One person bats, and you roll that first pencil, and it either falls on a run that you score, or it falls on "How's that?" And if it falls on "How's that?", then you've got your other pencil, and you've got the same effect with your other pencil. You've shaved the sides off, so you can write on each of the faces. And on that, you have 5 methods of getting out. And on the sixth side, you have a not out. And then if you land on "How's that?" on the first pencil, you roll the second one, and you find out how you've been out, or indeed if you're not out. And this is a game that can have multiple different sort of nuances and possibilities to it. You can do it in a one day setting, you can do it two overs a side, you can do it test matches, and you can be there for days.
Is it
And that's
possible to
actually.
game it in any way? When you played this, would you ever be, is there any way that you can be like, oh, if I just roll the pencil in that way, I'm guaranteed a six? Or is that not really in the spirit of things?
I don't think it's really in the spirit of it, because I think one of the great joys of, and this is one of the dividing things between these games, is games that are purely of games of luck and games that are games of skill. And Ours That is definitely a game that is a game of luck, essentially. Interestingly, in the book that we're going to review later, the author speculates that actually there is a degree of skill, and when he spent so much time losing at the game when he was younger, it's because he didn't really know the game very well. But I would speculate that actually that was because that was just bad luck rather than anything else, and he was using that as something of an excuse. But certainly this game kind of caught on in a pretty significant way. And between the wars, I think it was in 1936, the very first commercially released version of this came out, because of course the original version, all you need is two pencils and there's actually sort of no money involved at all. But what various companies started to realize is that for a huge cricket loving public, particularly young cricketers, the ability to, as you said at the beginning of the section, the ability to play cricket in inverted commas throughout the winter was a very important one. And actually their parents were quite glad of something to sort of keep them quiet. And so the game came out in numerous editions, and it actually kept on coming out until about the last version of it I could find was about 10 years ago. And you would have Brian Lara's version, a little bit like the computer games. You'd have versions that were brought out by various cricketers, and they'd have special packaging, and you could get them in the wooden box and the cork box and the leather box and all of these kinds of things. But generally, the commercially produced version consisted of little, a little bit like kind of if you imagine the end being sawn off a pencil. So you'd have a it would be sort of long and thin and still have those six sides that you would then roll and play the game that well. And really, that was the first cricketing game that started off the craze for games that sort of simulated cricket
I think
in other
the
ways.
genius of it, I mean, I can totally understand why it got commercialized, and it obviously made sense for a lot of people to do that. But the genius of it is how you simulate a game as complex as cricket with a couple of pencils. I mean, I just think that's absolutely inspired. I mean, the original inventor, there is some wonderful ingenuity at show. Now, moving beyond pencils, there have been other imaginative attempts to recreate cricket.
There have been all kinds of ways. One more slightly complicated way is the game armchair cricket, and that's the one I play quite a lot when I was a child. And it's a little bit like top trumps. You have two packs of cards, and in each pack of cards there are five suits. And by the way, I'm not going to sit here and explain all the rules, because it genuinely would take hours. But basically, the top trumps bit of this is that you have a batsman and a bowler. And the bowler bowls a card, so they take off a card and they lay it down, and the batsman has to, if he can't he ha if he can only lay a card that's lower than that, he's out. If he can only lay a card that's equal to it's a dot ball, and if he can lay a card that's higher than it, then he starts playing runs. And again, this is he starts scoring runs. And again, this is a game where there are all kind of possible nuances, and you can introduce rules around no balls. You can introduce limitations that mean that lower order batsmen can score fewer runs. So actually, from something that's very simple, you can actually produce something incredibly complex and incredibly nuanced. And I remember certainly having long and very, very bitter arguments when I was 7 years old at school, because we would create these astonishingly complex systems of rules around the games that were, sort of grown up of their own, sort of
You
their
see,
own accord, as it were.
I always remember coming up with games like this with my brother, and so much of the fun was tweaking the rules yourself. And there would actually be a real sort of bit source of pride in coming up with that little adjustment that just makes the game that bit cleverer. And actually, as a sort of intellectual exercise for kids, it's quite a neat idea. You know, how can you start with something simple and then tweak it in a way that makes it more interesting but doesn't sort of ruin it either?
It does, and what it also does is it actually allows a genuine connection to the actual game of cricket, because what all of these games actually have in common is the fact that they really have absolutely nothing to do with cricket. And actually, it's in bringing in rules around no balls, and the fact that, I remember we always had this thing where one person could pick where the pitch was, and based on that, whether it was an overcast day in Headingley, and therefore a swing bowler would possibly be the person who would take it, more of the wickets. And because of that, we therefore weighted certain kinds of cards in particular ways. And it's actually in these tweaks that you actually get it sort of closer to cricket and more closely engaged with cricket than it would be otherwise. Because certainly some of the forms of games are very arbitrary. And an example of this is a game that's completely new to me, and unsurprisingly, because apparently it's very popular on the subcontinent among school children, which is called book cricket. And all you need is just a book, and you take it in turns just to open the book at a random page, and you look at the right-hand page, and you look at the page number, and the last digit of the page number is the number of runs, unless it's a naught, in which case you're out, or if it's an eight, in which case it's a no ball bowled by the bowler, and you get another go. I'm not sure what happens if it
Now,
lands on seven or nine, but anyway, you've just run a lot, I think. It's got lost in the long grass.
this is going to make me sound very sort of fogeyish and old managed, but I think the wonder of something like that is, a modern child fully equipped with iPhone, with Angry Birds and whatever, their threshold for boredom, as far as I, can see, seems exceptionally low. They're like, give me a screen, give me something like, how extraordinary that you can get entertainment out of effectively flicking pages of a book. I just think that's wonderful.
Well, I think actually, I don't know how recently this game has kind of been a craze, and I suspect it was something that kind of really developed before the age of the iPhone. But I think the other thing is, you can imagine, while you're at school, actually the only thing you're often allowed to have out is a book,
Of
and you
course,
can
yeah.
actually really get away with it, in the sense that if your teacher says, "What are you doing?" you're saying, "Oh, I'm just looking through my textbook to, find some important scientific thing that I'm interested in that you're teaching us about." And
Yeah.
certainly that was what we got away with a lot at school when I played a variant on this, which was calculator cricket, where on scientific calculators you have an option to create a randomly generated number, and so you can set it to say, "I want to create a randomly generated number between 0 and 1," and the first digit after the decimal point is the thing that you're kind of judged on, as it were. So by the same rules, if you get a 1, then you scored a single. If you get a 5, then you're out. If you get, I can't remember what the other options were actually. And I think we actually developed this thing where, if you get a 9, then it's rain, stop play, and you have to wait 10 minutes before the other person
Now,
can play a game and something like that.
the other thing these games seem to be testimony to is the sheer boredom of school children. I mean, this seems to just
Yeah,
be
quite.
endless children sort of sitting there. I mean, surely you must have looked a little bit suspicious. Wasn't your maths teacher like, why are these children so fascinated by their calculators?
By the go, well, in a maths class,
Yeah,
it's
I
clearly.
suppose you're
And the other thing
supposed to
about
look
that,
fascinated by your calculator, aren't you?
yeah, indeed. And the other great thing about it is you can just play it by yourself, actually. You just play it by yourself, and you take turns to be the batsman and the bowler. Because it's completely randomly generated, it's not as if you're playing chess against yourself, where, you're giving yourself an advantage one way or other. But
Are
really, the
we
most.
about to get into a tearful recollection here, Toby, of many happy playgrounds with you in the corner and your calculator,
Oh,
everyone
tr
else?
trust me, I used to spend hours in flights of fancy. It was back when Dominic Cork was my favourite cricketer, but we're not going there, because that really is another episode. But the possibly the greatest sort of cricket board game, as we've called them, but as we've heard, they're not really all board games. But the greatest version is a game very simply called the Test Match Cricket game. And it started off in the 1970s just as a game of chance, and you'd have a board, and on each side of them there'd be these little cardboard tabs, and one, you'd sit opposite the bowler if you were the batsman, and the bowler would pull out a tab, and they'd pull out the kind of ball that they were going to bowl, and then the batsman would pull out the tab, and he'd pull out whatever it was that he was going to play. So the bowler would pull out something that said, fast Yorker, and if the batsman pulled out, because it was all done, you couldn't see what you were going to pull out. If you pulled out a thing that said, hook shot, then clearly you were going to be bowled. And this developed in the 1980s to take on an interactive and actually quite skill-based format. And this was really the big 3D skill-based cricket game that existed. And basically, it was a piece of felt that you spread out on a table. It was kind of probably about 30 centimeters in diameter. And you would have little inch-high characters that you put around it, and they were the fielders. And you had a batsman, and you had a bowler, and the person playing the bowler controlled the bowler, and the person playing the batsman controlled the batsman. And it was all these little spring-loaded figures. So you would flick the ball from the bowler, and then the batsman at the other end, controlled by your opposition, would play a shot and play it into the fielders. And certainly I remember at school, in wet games, as again as we called them, playing this game for absolutely hours on end and being fascinated by it. And we always used to be, I'll be Joel Garner and you can be, Brian Close or whatever it was. Always used to kind of imbue it with this enormous imagination as well. And I think that's the joy of these games, that actually they're only so good as the imagination of the people who are playing them and what they can actually project onto them.
I remember playing this and thinking it was just absolutely beautiful. It was sort of cricket's version of Sabutio. It was sort of wonderfully arranged. The only flaw I remember was that when you would play a particularly over-energetic off drive, the version I played had a sort of felt carpet underneath it, and
Yeah,
you would often
exactly.
end up, your off drive would often end up sort of taking out a large chunk of this felt carpet as well. It would sort of bunch it up, so you'd cause kind of destruction in the field. It was kind of, if you'd imagine that sort of Chris Gayle's bat had grown even larger, and every time he sort of struck the ball, it actually caused a minor earthquake in the offside. But no, it's wonderful. I suggest, Toby, what we're going to do at some point is we're going to play one of these games and record us live playing one of these games. And
I'm certainly game for that. So the review, and for this episode, we have been reading "Fatty Batter: How Cricket Saved My Life, Then Ruined It" by Michael Simpkins. Now, Michael Simpkins describes himself as a jobbing actor. He's performed in any number of West End shows and has had hundreds of appearances on TV, where his self-declared speciality is, quotes, experts, policemen, or unsuspecting husbands. He's got previous as an author. His memoir on acting life, which is called What's My Motivation, was published in 2004 and became a bestseller. And Fatty Batter is a book. It's a sort of autobiography, actually, and it's about the tale of his discovery and then his obsession with cricket. Now, I have a confession to make, and I think it's something that we both share, which is that we really didn't expect much of this book. In terms of its company in the world of cricket literature, there are quite a lot of books that are based on people's, kind of amusing, humorous anecdotes about their life with cricket, and on the whole, they're pretty awful. And I have to say, I've actually read it all over the last couple of days in a day and a half, whilst also being at a music festival. And I kind of demolished it from cover to cover in the space of not very many hours. And I actually loved every single page of it. And I think, Andy, you're the same. Why do you think that is?
Well, perhaps part of it is the sort of joy of low expectations, because I started exactly the
True.
same, and I think it's very much the fault of the fact there is this very well-mined genre of, oh, isn't village cricket such a laugh, da, da, da. And generally those books get a bit tedious,
And
and
we made
most
a joke about farting and, jock
and
straps in the dressing room.
most crucially, they're just not that funny, and this book manages both to be genuinely laugh out loud funny, but also insightful and occasionally quite moving. I guess on the insightful and moving side of things, I was really interested in sort of how Simpkins comes to cricket, because I think I was sort of someone who it was very much cricket was brought to me. I guess it was sort of a family thing. It was just passed on. I can't really pin down a defining moment or experience when I became into cricket. Simpkins, on the other hand, offers this wonderful description about how the sight of the barrel-chested Colin Milburn on telly was this almost epiphany for him, because he was, by his own description, as the title of the book somewhat gives away, he was a large teenager. Michael Simpkins, and for him to see this, big man playing so brilliantly at an international level, and it reminded me that actually we owe a lot, I think, to the eccentrics and mavericks in cricket, because often they're the ones that pull fans in, and it's only then that fans think, oh, I'm going to get really invested in this.
One of the interesting things I think about the book is how genuinely it weaves together events in Simpkins's life with the kind of developments of his love for cricket. And throughout the book, we go through a lot of different stages in terms of his engagement with cricket. It's never just me watching cricket through the ages. And actually, the book is a succession of anecdotes of different ways, all the way through from growing up playing cricket in his parents' sweet shop, through to becoming a in a bizarre situation, a cricket journalist through to running his own team. And one of the, I mean, one for me, one of the most brilliant descriptions in the whole book, and actually it was very reminiscent for me of that way that cricket can just be played in any circumstance. And we were talking about it in relation to sort of cricket board games earlier, how things can be adapted, is when he does first play cricket and he plays it in his parents' sweet shop. And I just want to read a quick description of that. He says this: "The rules of shop cricket are complex. A nudge into the crisp boxes at third man counts as a single. A clip past the soft drinks dispenser next to them at backward point counts as two, as does a hit into the loose toffees at cover. A lofted drive over their heads into the raspberry ruffles at deep extra is a boundary, as are the ciggy shells at long on and long off, although I avoid them as there's always the chance of Dad intercepting and taking a smart return catch."
I think it's a brilliant passage for showing that so much of the first part of this book is just gloriously nostalgic, and in the hands of the wrong author, I think it would be a bit kitsch and a bit corny. But Simkins gets the tone just right. I mean, it's like the first day when he goes to Hove, and it is exactly like the day at county cricket that so many of us remember. Half the crowd asleep, the other half reading newspapers, but he's captivated by it. Again, it's a real workman. In the second half of the book, it does get much more into his playing career, and I think this is where he does really well, because I think these village cricket memoirs often go so wrong, and the mistake so many writers make is they assume that we as readers want to know every detail of every humdrum game, that we care about every aspect of Billy's private life and whatever. But instead, he kind of gets these match reports just right. They really cut to the chase. Every single one is kind of structured around a single theme, a single anecdote. And I think there's sort of plenty to enjoy here.
He does, and the nice thing about that is that actually he doesn't give a sort of definitive. So he sets up a cricket team named after, and actually I've forgotten the name
Harry
off the top of my
Baldwin.
head, Harry Baldwin. There we go.
The Harry
who
Baldwin
he is
Occasionals, yeah.
attracted to, the Harry Baldwin Occasionals, who he's attracted to simply for the reason that Harry Baldwin, in his picture in this kind of Victorian picture book of the golden age of cricket that he owns, Harry Baldwin is the fat one who's kind of still pulling on his trousers in the picture, and looks like the kind of guy that Simpkins kind of imagined himself to be when he was growing up. And he only actually really gives you the reports that are kind of the interesting ones. Before that, there's this extraordinary sort of passage in the book where he sets his heart on the idea of becoming a TMS commentator, and I think that's something that we can all identify with. And he ends up responding to this ad in the paper, and it's an advertisement for a position providing cricket commentary down the phone to people who phone in. Now, of course, those kinds of scenarios are usually not cricket commentary that are being provided. They're rather more exciting and racy things that are being provided by the phone down the phone by the benefit of people who ring up and listen by the minute. But I think it's a really interesting kind of reminder of the fact that, as he goes through life, he interacts with cricket in all of these different ways, and he actually ends up, at the end of that sort of journalist stint, if you can even call it journalism, actually saying, I actually don't like cricket anymore. The actual, need to sit there and actually concentrate on every single ball and not wander off, as he puts it, and go and look at the charity shops on the high street, is actually something that he finds quite oppressive. And actually, him putting it the way he put it then actually really sort of struck a chord with me in a way that it hasn't when I've kind of heard similar sentiments with other authors.
Yeah, it did remind me a lot of Miles Jupp's Fibber in the Heat that we reviewed many episodes ago on this podcast, where you have someone who it's always been their dream, and you forget that there's a real privilege to being a fan and just being free to enjoy something on its own terms. I think it is this balance between sort of the insightful funny and the genuinely moving that works really well here. And I think a nice way of sort of summing up, there's a wonderful match report that focuses on the challenges of pulling together a starting 11, and the way you go from having 13 players to 7 players to 9 players to players pulling out to someone saying, "Oh, my son wants a game," to, "Oh, my son doesn't want a
Yes.
game," or, "Oh, my, I'm flying back from Dubai," or, "I'm not flying back." And I, not only was it hilarious, but it was also just about realistic enough. And I think anyone who's been involved in any sports team, I fortunately do not currently have the dubious pleasure of captaining my cricket team, but it, you know, I'm very aware, and I think we all have this awful challenge of getting a team together. I think on the other end of the scale, his final game, I think, for the Harry Baldwin Occasionals, where he turns up and this team that, as you said, I mean, he founded it, was a real passion project and he runs, and suddenly the dressing room is full of these men a lot younger than him who don't know him, and someone actually asks him, "Oh, have you played for us before?" And he sort of smiles and is like, "Well, I founded the team." And it's this rather sad sense of he realizes his retirement without him knowing on it, knowing about it, has sort of crept up on him. He knows now that it's his time to go.
So that is Fatty Batter by Michael Simpkins. We thought we were going to hate it, and we certainly didn't. I think that's a fair summary. I'm
Very
sure it's
fair.
available at all the available at all good bookstores or whatever they say in these in this official way. So that concludes the 80th episode, would you believe it, of Reverse Swept Radio. We'll be releasing the box set very shortly. Thank you as ever for listening. You can find us over on Twitter at Reverse Swept. Get in touch if you feel so inclined, and we look forward to your joining us very soon. Thank you.